So we're starting week, we're going to talk about the second lecture, the second chapter of Abolition of Man. Remember C.S. Lewis, if you've been with us, even though he studied literature, he really was a philosopher at heart. And in fact, many of the students that studied with him in his whole duration at Oxford and on into Cambridge were actually students studying philosophy. And this is showing his chops. This lecture series, these three lectures that were put into the book, Abolition of Man, are really showing his philosophical chops. And again, it's a little different than his apologetic works. We've talked about that. There's multiple pieces of his fiction that are intertwined with this. There's an essay called The Ethics of Subjectivism, The Poison of Subjectivism, that he's writing at the same time. In fact, we'll see today in the lecture, there's a little bit of intertwining with Mere Christianity that he unpacks a little bit more in Abolition of Man. But let's get started. So we ended last week, and I'm just going to read as a refresher, just a two short paragraphs near the end of the first lecture. And remember, he introduces this idea of the head, the chest, and the belly. The head is raw intellect, man who is raw brain power, like the angels. Animalistic, like beasts, is the belly, the koilia of man. And then he argues, remember what term, the L word he uses for, what does he use? The chest is a what between the two? Good, it's supposed to act like a liaison officer. This idea of the chest needs to, the head rules the belly through the chest, is how he argues. So that's why the chapter, or the lecture, is entitled Men Without Chests. He's introducing this kind of tripartite man. And to be truly human, so that's the argument, to be truly human, we have to have that liaison officer, that chest. And so right near the end of the first lecture, he says, without the aid of trained emotions, the intellect is powerless against the animal organism. I had sooner play cards against a man who was quite skeptical about ethics, but bred to believe that a gentleman does not cheat, than against an irreproachable moral philosopher who had been brought up among sharpers, or card sharks is what he means there. In battle, it is not syllogisms that will keep the reluctant nerves and muscles to their post in the third hour of bombardment. The crudest sentimentalism, such as Gaius and Titius would wince at, remember the authors of the Green Book, about flag or country or regiment, will be of more use. We were told it all long ago by Plato, that the king governs by his executive. In other words, reason in man must rule the mere appetites by means of the spirited element. The head rules the belly through the chest. The chest is the seat of magnanimity. Remember that huge word, greatness of soul, of virtue. So the head rules the belly through the chest. It's the seat of magnanimity, of emotions organized by trained habit into stable sentiments. And this is where you see his Aristotelianism coming through strong. I'll talk a little bit more of that in a minute. But he says, remember, it's trained habits that matter. Sentiments. And remember, he's not a rationalist. He's not saying reason above all else. Because what brought him, you know, he called himself the most reluctant convert in all of England. And he said God drew him. But what he was striving to find is mere sentiments. What are good emotions? Not to abolish emotion, but how do I understand how I should love the world? That's what he was striving for. His entire, that literally was Lewis's project in all of his academic works and fictional works. And so this is what he's struggling with. The chest, magnanimity, or sentiment, these are the indispensable liaison officers between cerebral and visceral man. It may even be said that by the middle element, man is man. For by his intellect, he is mere spirit. By his appetites, mere animal. And the operation of the green book and its kind is to produce what may be called men without chests. And then he goes on just very short little bit, and then I ended with that last paragraph we ended last time. So that's where he ends it. That's where he drops the lecture. And so this is where he opens up the second night. Remember, three nights of lectures. This is how he opens the second lecture. And this is called The Way. Remember, he introduces the topic. We talked about it briefly last week. The whole chapter is about it this week on the Tao. The Tao. And his opening sentence for the lecture is, "The practical result of education in the spirit of the Green Book must be the destruction of society which accepts it." Destruction of society which accepts it. So this idea of subjectivism, Lewis is really being prophetic in this writing. And it's a little bit of a rare voice for him. But remember, from the very first lecture 2 weeks ago, he argues that this is his most important work. And he wished it was more well-read, remember, in these letters to American Lady. And so this idea is very clear, very direct, very concrete. He says, if the practical result is we'll destroy a society that's fully subjective. But this is not necessarily a refutation of subjectivism about values as a theory. The true doctrine might be a doctrine which, if we accept, we die. No one who speaks from within the Tao could reject it on this account, but it has not yet come to that. There are theoretical difficulties in the philosophy of Gaius and Titius. And so the philosophical difficulties, number one, I put on our basic outline here is the ironic dilemma. So what he goes on then, if some of you brought up copies, I appreciate it. You've ordered the copies since we started talking about it. Some of you have emailed me. I've had interactions. So thanks for the texts and the emails about some of these questions. But in this section, the ironic dilemma for him is he begins to unpack what we would call, if you've had basic logic, if you remember back to college or philosophy 101, a self-refuting argument. He goes on to engage this idea that if Gaius and Titius, he argues that what they're doing, he spends about 3 or 4 pages doing this, if what they're doing is trying to, you know, subvert certain sentiments, he said they're not trying to, it'd be irrational to subvert all emotion or all sentiment. He said what they're really doing is they're smuggling in the ideas they don't like your emotional engagements or your sentiments, and they're wanting to bring other sentiments in their place. And he goes, no person, no moral philosopher just talks about raw facts. Kind of the imperative versus the indicative. Remember, he loves English, the English language. But this is the idea of like a self-refuting argument. And this is what he argues they're trying to do. They're trying to use this statement. There is no such thing as objective value. That's their statement. There is no such thing as objective value. Well, what's wrong with that statement? Possibly. Because why? Yeah, or an assumption that cuts off the argument, right? There's no such thing as objective value. If that's what they're trying to get us to learn, well, they're using the Tao to try to bring in this concept, but still trying to have their cake and eat it too, if you will. And so he shows this ironic dilemma that as moral philosophers, they're simply trying to bring up another value, not abolish all values. Because there's a difference between like the door, you know, that is a door. That's just a descriptive statement, right? There's a door. It's a different thing, quite a different thing to say, I should go through that door, or those door, those doors ought to be shut. When I was starting to talk, right, and everybody was dispersing out, if for me to say, please shut, those doors ought to be shut. It's a different kind of use of language for me describing there's a door than the type of emotional statement saying that door ought to. So it's the moral oughtness. This is what moral philosophers, the moment you say something is right or wrong, or you ought to do something, or you shouldn't do something, this is where moral philosophy is. How do we determine right and wrong, good from bad, evil, etc.? And he's like, if they're really wanting to be subjective, they're having a hard time. They're not being honest. Because they can't literally say, he says later on, the important point is not that the precise nature of their end, the authors, but the fact that they have an end at all. They must have, or their book should have, they must have, or their book, being purely practical in intention, it's written to no purpose. And this is the end that must have real value in their eyes. To abstain from calling it good, and to use instead such predicates as necessary, progressive, or efficient, would be subterfuge. They could be forced by argument to answer the question, necessary for what? Progressing towards what? Effecting what? So what he's trying to poke at in their English textbook, remember he's kind of frustrated that this idea is being smuggled into a textbook teaching junior hires how to think about language. And for Lewis, language is how we enter rationality. Language is how we understand the world around us. And he's making a major argument that the language they're using is essentially leading people to be inhuman. And he points that out over and over. And he said the way they people shy away, and you'll find this now, you'll find this in certain HR circles, you'll find this a lot in political arguments, political philosophy. Hardly anyone likes to use the terms good, bad, evil, the oughtness, this something that is versus should be. People don't like to get into those conversations at all in many sectors. And so he's saying, and this time they could not, he's saying their language, they move from good or bad, evil, that uses of language, to something like necessary. This is a necessary thing, or this is a progressive thing, or an efficient thing. And he's trying to point out that the language they're using, they're just playing with words. And this time, they could not maintain that good simply described their own emotions about it. For the whole purpose of their book is so to condition the young reader that he will share their approval. And this would either be a fool's or a villain's undertaking unless they held that their approval was in some way valid or correct. So what he's trying to point out, he takes 4 or 5 pages to simply show they wrote the book because they have a point to write the book. And he's using logic playfully. Lewis is a real playful writer. And he's trying to show anybody who writes a book or writes a thing or engages in an argument, unless they are, a pure actor, has some invested value in writing or talking or engaging the idea. And he said, so the book itself, they obviously have a point to get across. And he said, I'm going to take them at face value. When somebody tells you who they are, believe them. You've heard that phrase before. And he's like, I'm going to take them at face value. They're wanting us to get rid of all subjective value. And he begins to pick philosophically at what they're trying to do. He says, a great many of those who debunk tradition, or as they would say, sentimental values, have in the background values of their own, which they believe to be immune from the debunking process. They claim to be cutting away the parasitic growth of emotion, or religious sanction, or inherited taboos, tradition, in order to be real or basic and have values that may emerge. I will now try to find out what happens if this is seriously attempted. And then he goes on to talk a little bit more. It becomes simply utilitarian. The ends justify the means. And he comes back to that Latin phrase, dulce et decorum. And the idea of, remember, it's in wartime. Remember, he was a World War I survivor, seriously wounded. It took him over 8 months to recover. And then this is an engaged argument in the middle of World War II. So he has the World War I experience. He recovers. He becomes a tutor at Oxford. And then now we're in the middle of World War II. He's done radio. He's written sermons. Not very many, but a few. He's writing serial articles in the newspapers. He's on the radio doing these kinds of things. And this is a formal academic lecture where in the middle of World War II, he uses this example that it's sweet, and this is from Horace, the Stoic, it's sweet and becoming to die for one's country. That's a theme he weaves through all three lectures. It is sweet and becoming to die for one's country. Because all around them, hundreds of thousands of British boys were dying. It would have been a very accessible illustration, particularly at this time. And he says, first of all, if somebody says it's sweet and becoming to die for one's country, or, and he quotes John, greater love hath no man than this, the Green Book, the authors of the Green Book say these are mere irrational sentiments which are to be stripped off in order that we may go down all the way to the realistic or basic ground of value. Where will he find such grounding, moral grounding, that's what we talk about, the foundation of which we build our beliefs upon? First of all, he might say that the real value lay in the utility of such a sacrifice for the community. Good, he might say, means what is useful to the community. But of course, the death of the community is not useful to the community. Only the death of some of its members. What is really meant is that death of some men is useful to other men. That is very true. But on what grounds are some men being asked to die for the benefit of others? So he's saying when you ask, you know, when you boil it all down, when you make, you know, some men need to sacrifice for good and God and country, how we say it now. What leads a person to do such a thing? What will have them engage in that action? Because if you just say, yes, yeah, some of you need to die, what would be a natural question? If that was you, that was your ticket, right? Well, why me? I mean, this is all kinds of, you know, youth literature is about this now, you know, and in the past 10 years, a lot written on it. A lot of movies have this, you know. Why would you sacrifice yourself? And what some of you have served in the military or are serving or in law enforcement or these kinds of things, you know, what's a common refrain, either from popular culture or in your own mind? Why do people do the kind of sacrificial thing or that could lead to a sacrificial act? Why do people do it? Is it because, well, the community needs it? What do you hear? What would have movies taught us to think, or what do you think? Come on, speak back. Why do some people choose to go into professions or to jump into the trenches, etc.? Why do people do it? For the man or woman next to you, right? That's very common. You hear that. It's for you. You've trained together, the regiment, etc. That's really number one. What else? Yeah, for some sort of ideal. Like, I am going to do this. I'm going to sacrifice because these ideas that I believe in are important. And in this case, freedom. Good. What else? Yeah. And sometimes it's familial. Well, my uncle served, my dad served. There's like a genealogical service connection. Absolutely. Anything else?
Well, there is a power.
Yeah. So a certain kind of training, maybe, is that what you're saying? Like training has gone into an expectation. This is my aim. Yeah, the telos, the end name or goal of what I'm doing is to be a soldier and is to fight. Good. And that's some of the tensions. This is a total tangent, but that's some of the temptation of trying to figure out what is a warfighter doing, especially on peacekeeping. You know, when you say, we're going to send a bunch of our soldiers over to do peacekeeping, you know, there's a lot of confusion sometimes about what we're supposed to be doing. But that we'll bracket that. That's a whole other political philosophy argument. Yes? Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Well, in America, yeah. For sure, in America too, the idea of education. As soon as you attach the GI Bill to the military, a lot of people are like, well, if I can do my 6 years, I can get a degree, get out there, do these things. So yeah, no, there's all kinds of motivations, but rarely the most basic idea Lewis is arguing is, well, some of you just need to die. He's like that doesn't play because there's all these other reasons behind it, which he calls the Tao. This idea of natural law is behind it. And he goes, okay, so these innovators, these conditioners might be telling us, you know, there's a reason to do this. And the major reason, number two, he argues, he spends a third of the lecture now talking about, well, one possible reason that to get to these basic truths, basic in quotes, is instinct. He said, this he will probably feel that he has found, the conditioners, found in the concept of instinct. This is why people do things. To preserve society, it's just instinctual. And this is where directly related to his, this section is directly informed by his radio chats in Mere Christianity. Because in Mere Christianity, I think it was three or four radio moments that he gave, and the BBC received such an outpouring of letters and notes back to them about his lectures, they asked him to come back for a fourth, where he literally, on the air, simply answered all the letters that came in. And the major theme that came up in these letters when he was talking about Mere Christianity was like, well, no, it's just instinctual. Whether you believe or you don't believe, this idea of instinct kept coming up over and over. And so for a year and a half or so, remember the date of this to the date of Mere Christianity, or the radio talks, what became chapter 2 in Mere Christianity is what he's dealing with here in this idea, well, it's just instinct. What we do is just instinctual, it's natural. It's electricity and juice, or a materialist argument. And he says, well, yeah, some people will appeal to instinct. The preservation of society and the species itself are ends that do not hang on the precarious thread of reason. They're given to us by instinct. That's what he's saying their argument is. That's why there's no need to argue against the man who does not acknowledge them. We have instinctive urge to preserve our own species. And then he goes on later, it looks, in fact, as if ethics, based on instinct, will give the innovator all he wants and nothing he does not want. And he says, pause, time out. In reality, we have not advanced one step. I will not insist on the point that instinct is a name for we know not what. In other words, to say that migratory birds find their way by instinct is only to say we don't know how migratory birds find their way. For I think it is here being used in a fairly definitive sense to mean an unreflective or spontaneous impulse widely felt by the members of a given species. So what he's arguing is commonality. What we could come to agree what certain instincts are because we all have them to a certain degree about certain things. In what way does instinct, thus conceived, help us find real value? Is it maintained that we must obey instinct? That we cannot do otherwise? But if so, why are green books and others like it written? Why is this stream of exhortation to drive us where we can't help but go? You see what his argument is here? He's saying if our instincts, if we're wanting to reduce how we know right from wrong or how we know what to do at all is merely instinctual, why do we have to write books about it? Because we'll just do it. That's his argument. You see where he's going with that? We'll just act on it. And so philosophers call this a certain level of type of determinism. If we're just determined, if our instincts tell us what to do, and we're determined to do so, well, there's no need to teach. There's no need to write about it. There's no, because we'll just do it. And Lewis is like, no. He goes, this can't possibly be the argument. It looks very much as if the innovator would have to say not that we must obey instinct, nor that it will satisfy us to do so, but that we ought to obey instinct. So he's saying they're playing into this self-refuting trap. But why ought they to obey instinct? Is there another instinct of a higher order directing us to do that? And a third, still higher order, directing us to obey it? Essentially, an infinite regress of instinct. This is presumably impossible, but nothing else will serve. From the statement about psychological fact, I have an impulse to do such and such, we cannot by any ingenuity derive the practical principle, I ought to do that. Even if it were true that men had a spontaneous, unreflective impulse to sacrifice their own lives for the preservation of their fellows, it remains a quite separate question whether this is an impulse that they should control or one they should indulge. For even the innovator admits that many impulses conflict with the preservation of the species and have to be controlled. And this admission surely introduces us to a yet more fundamental difficulty. Here's one of the most, I want to make a bumper sticker or a t-shirt. Telling us to obey instinct is like telling us to obey people. People say different things, and so do instincts. So again, he's using logic to show that instinctually, if you go from person to person and say, what are your appetites? What is your instinct telling you to do? You get all kinds of different answers to that question. He argues our instincts are at war. If it is held that the instinct for preserving the species should always be obeyed at the expense of other instincts, where do we derive this rule of precedence? By the very act of listening to one rather than others, we've already prejudged the case. The idea that without appealing to any court higher than the instinct itself, where can we find grounds for preferring one instinct above its fellows? So this idea of instinct, and he goes on for 4 or 5 pages unpacking this concept. He goes, that's pretty much all they're left with is instinctual, what I feel like doing, what I'm determined to do. And if you remember, in the first chapter, in the first lecture, he quotes Lewis, quotes Aristotle, he quotes Plato, and he talks about this idea of trained habits, training, how we learn. Children, that's why, again, he is so offended. Because children are being trained by their parents, by their teachers, in all kinds of ways. He has no problem, remember, with adults coming with converging ideas. And remember, he was willing to do battle. He created one of the chief debating clubs at Oxford called the Oxford Socratic Club, where he brought people in who believed disparate things and put the best options of those available and let them intellectually duke it out and a few times physically duke it out as emotions got heated in that venue. His concern is with children. And what we're talking about, how do we train and educate our children? And remember, educare, the word education means to draw out, not to cram in. And the opposite, you know, education is not indoctrination. And the vivid imagery that a philosopher, that is Plato's cave. Remember your Plato's Apology where he's talking about Plato's cave, and there's perceptions of reality. There's prisoners chained in a cave. There's a fire behind them, and they're chained, and they see the wall, and they see the shadows. So they see the perceptions of reality, but they don't see real reality. And they have to break those chains of perception and climb out of this classic, right? If you're familiar with this. And this is the idea of education, to draw out, to draw out of darkness into light. That is the word education. How do I correspond what I know to be true to what is really true? It's a profound idea. And he's saying, this is where 10 years hence, the young schoolboy who thought he was doing his literature or his English will, when he's faced with a religious, an ethical, a political question, will make a decision on it, and he will not remember why he's making a decision here or there, but it's because of these types of... So he's feeling this, right? That's from the first chapter. That's the opening lecture. And he's pulling this logically all the way through. And he goes on then, only people educated in a particular way have ever had the idea of posterity put before their minds at all. And he brings in this concept of parentage. And if instinct tells us to care, he brings in this idea of having a baby. If somebody were to tell you about, we need to care about mankind. Well, yeah, generally that's true. What's the better argument? What is he saying? What's a closer argument? What's an argument most of us can see a little better? Do we need to care for mankind? Or is it more clearly to say, we need to care for our children? He said, most people, they understand caring for the baby crowing in the room, in the nursery next to us. We understand the caring for our own progeny, our own children, and maybe our grandchildren. But as soon as you extend it much beyond, it's really hard to care for some sort of amorphous thing like mankind or all of future mankind. But I do care for Sojourn, Ariston, Selah, and Aletheia because they're real, concrete, they're in front of me. My instincts, it has to be more than merely that. No parent who are guided by this instinct would dream of a moment of setting up the claims of their hypothetical descendants against those of the baby actually crowing and kicking in the room next to them. Those of us who accept the Tao may perhaps say they ought to do so, but that is not open to those who treat instinct as the source of value. As we pass from mother love to rational planning for the future, we're passing away from the realm of instinct into the realm of choice and reflection. So essentially what Lewis is arguing, anytime there's a moment where I have to reflect and think about why I am doing this, why should I, he says, you're entering into a philosophical conversation and you're inside the Tao. Anybody who tries to undercut that or is so unreflexive, non-thinking, he argues that if you want to be that type of person, you're actually inhuman. Almost all of what we do is reflexively, we think about it in a certain kind of way. And then he engages this as he moves on, but then I do not believe that instinct is the ground for value judgment. What is absurd is to claim that your care for posterity finds its justification in instinct, and then flout at every turn the only instinct on which it could be supposed to rest, tearing the child almost from the breast to the creche and the kindergarten in the interest of progress and the coming race. The truth finally becomes apparent that neither in any operation with factual propositions nor in any appeal to instinct can the innovator find the basis for a system of values. None of the principles he requires are to be found there. They're all to be found somewhere else. And then he goes on to quote Confucius. This is where some people who read Lewis in different settings, or Chronicles of Narnia, some of these other, they're like, whoa, he brings in this pluralistic argument. He quotes Confucius, he quotes the Stoics, he quotes John Locke, he quotes the book of John, all in this litany, just boom, 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 boom. All practical principles, and at the end of quoting, all the practical principles behind the innovator's case for posterity or society or the species are there from the immemorial in the Tao. And he's showing from all these traditions, people don't believe in this raw instinctual choice. But they are nowhere else. Unless you accept these without question as being in the world of action, what axioms are to the world of theory, you can have no practical principles whatsoever. If nothing is self-evident, nothing can be proved. Similarly, if nothing is obligatory for its own sake, nothing is obligatory at all. So instinct. He hears the people, he's using what he learned on his radio address to say many people think that instinct is how we know right from wrong. Remember, that's one of the topics of mere Christianity, right and wrong. I think it's chapter 1. And he says, as I hear you, how we know right from wrong is instinct. So he just cuts off this idea of instinct can't possibly be the way. The Tao is more the way. And so number 3, this is what leads to his engagement, what we call practical reason or natural law. He's like, since I can see no answer to these questions about instinct, I draw the following conclusion. This thing which I have called for convenience the Tao, which others may call natural law or traditional morality or first principles of practical reason, it is not one among a series of systemic values. It is the sole source for all value judgment. This is where he puts all of his cards on the table. He's making the argument that the Tao, this idea of truth about how the world is, am I corresponding my life to what is really real? He's like, it is the sole source of all value judgments. So again, agree or disagree, all the cards are on the table. All traditional morality, even where it disagrees in certain aspects, all lives within this Tao. It's the sole source of all value judgment. If it is rejected, all value is rejected. If any value is retained, it's retained. The effort to refute it and raise a new system of value in its place is self-contradictory. The rebellion of new ideologies against the Tao is a rebellion of the branches against the tree. If the rebels could succeed, they would find that they had destroyed themselves. The classic cartoon of a guy sitting on a branch with a saw and he's cutting the branch. Well, what's going to happen is he cuts a little deeper, right? He will find that he destroyed that. That's the argument Lewis is making. And so this idea of natural law, remember I was arguing in Oxford, this idea of natural law theory, it's still taught. This John Finnis, I think I shared the first lecture, one of my co-workers was a student of John Finnis, who was one of the top natural law lawyers, philosophers in the world. He was an Australian, and he was at Oxford too. There's a long history. Robbie George, who's at Princeton, Dr. George, is in this, the Catholic philosopher and thinker is in this tradition as well. And so he's introducing this idea. It goes all the way back. Some will say it starts in Aristotle. Some say you can engage it through Thomas Aquinas. Lewis, interestingly, doesn't lean on Aquinas. He's like, I think he called himself a weak Thomist. But a lot, like in Catholic social teaching, it goes back to Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Theologica. Lewis says, no, it's just straight back to Aristotle and the golden mean. Anybody want to take a stab when I say golden mean, what that means? It was from his Nicomachean Ethics. Good. So this Aristotelian concept is pretty simple. You're trying to find like virtues. When thinking about a virtue of courage, the classic one from Aristotle, and you think about a spectrum between deficiency, when you have an excess or a deficiency of something, there's a spectrum. And in courage, in wartime, this would have meant a lot to Lewis, an excess of courage would be what? What trait would be an excess of courage? What's that? Recklessness or rash, being rash, reckless, trying to determine when one, in the wartime, you know, we always see some sort of level of sacrifice. In there are certain war movies, and you see some of it celebrated, some of it denigrated based on all kinds of scenarios, but a lot of times it has to do with people higher up making people in the trenches do certain acts. And trying to determine which ones of those are virtuous. So if you have rashness on one side, what's a deficiency of courage? Cowardice. Running away. Abandoning the man on your side. The man or woman on your side in the trenches. And so this is a very, when you think through different virtues, courage is just the classic one that Aristotle uses, and what he's talking about here about dying, why should somebody die for one's country, there's a spectrum between excess and deficiency of that virtue. You can think about love this way. There's all kinds of books written about boundaries, right? Because some people don't, you know, some people just give, and some people are so hard, people break against them because they have no love. There's this spectrum. When you think about a virtue, it's a pretty basic concept. You see that spectrum between the excess and deficiency of a virtue. And this is where what are these virtues? How do we understand them? And how do we understand how to act between excess and deficiency? And the golden mean is where we should aim for. Right? And so Lewis, again, thoroughly entrenched in Aristotelianism, is playing with this through the rest of the chapter. And he ends, as he talks about natural law, let me just read from here. From within the Tao itself comes the only authority to modify the Tao. So the natural law, he said, to have natural law either is or it isn't. This is what Confucius meant when he said, with those who follow a different way, it is useless to take counsel. This is why Aristotle said that only those who have been well brought up can usefully study ethics. To the corrupted man, the man who stands outside the Tao, the very starting point of this science is invisible. He may be hostile, but he cannot be critical because he does not know what is being discussed. He literally doesn't understand. This is why it is also said, this people that knoweth the law is accursed, and he that believeth shall not be damned. An open mind, this is now back to Lewis, an open mind in questions that are not ultimate is useful. Being open-minded, think, you know, we hear this, you know, keep an open mind, right? You still hear that to this day. This is 80 years later. But an open mind about the ultimate foundations, either of theoretical or practical reason, is idiocy. If a man's mind is open on these things, let at least his mouth be shut. So Sounds like he was around before Twitter was, but that's a Twitter, like, you know, that's a subtweet of something. He's subtweeting something there, right? An open mind about ultimate foundations, either of theoretical or practical reason, is idiocy. If a man's mind is open about these things, let at least his mouth be shut. He can say nothing to the purpose. Outside the Tao, there's no ground for criticizing either the Tao or anything else. Because we're back to instinct, like it just determined. And so, and again, I know some of you have interacted with me a little bit about this, but this is where he says, I am simply arguing that if we have values at all, we must accept the ultimate platitudes of practical reason as having absolute validity. That having attempt that becoming skeptical about these is to reintroduce lower values. And in order to avoid misunderstanding, I may add that although I myself am a theist and indeed a Christian, he makes both moves, I am not here attempting any indirect argument for theism. So remember his audience, an asked lecture, a three-night lecture at the University of Durham in front of other philosophers, historians, etc. And he's like, I'm not trying to make this argument. I'm trying to get you to see where real value, if you reject any kind of value that's external to oneself, if you make it all internal and instinctual, that it simply isn't true. Some people have argued that, well, even though he says that, he's still, if it's true, we know the ultimate, you know, I mean, and then there's whole essays. I could give you a whole raft of essays on why people think this is smuggling Christianity. But he's literally saying, look, just to try to engage, this idea is not what I'm doing. And then I'm going to end here. You say we shall have no values at all if we step outside the Tao. He's saying that what somebody might say to him. Very well. We shall probably find that we can get on quite comfortably without the Tao. Let us regard all ideas of what we ought to do simply as an interesting psychological survival. Let us step right outside of all of that and start doing what we like. Let us decide for ourselves what man is to be and make him into that, not on any ground of imagined value, but because we want him to be so. We want man to be like me, so let's just do it. Having mastered our environment, let us now master ourselves and choose our own destiny. This is a very possible position, Lewis says. This is possible. This is real. And those who hold it cannot be accused of self-contradiction, like the half-hearted skeptics, Gaius and Titius, who want to find real values when they've debunked traditional ones. But this is the rejection of a concept of value altogether. And I shall need another lecture to engage it. So this is why I want you to come back next week. Lecture 1 and Lecture 2 build into Lecture 3, which gets very practical. And this is where he's at his most prophetic. He looks forward, and Lewis, again, this is not Lewis's norm. He looks forward and he starts to be prophetic about if you debunk all value, and so he almost like brackets the Tao and says, if you reject all of that, that's a possibility. If you step outside of value, that's a possibility. Now let's see where that goes. Let's take it to its logical conclusion. And Lecture 3, Chapter 3, engages very clearly the moment he is in. He starts with the talking about contraception, the airplane, and the radio. And this is where, in my little blurb in the bulletin, if you're like, where does technology come into this? He talks about technological reach and what technology and advancements in technology could possibly mean in allowing man to supersede value. So it's going to be a lot of fun, a little more provocative next week. We have time for like two questions. Are there any questions that are just burning at you before I let you go?
What is the source of the Tao? Is it evolution?
There's a debate. He wasn't a strong evolutionist. Lewis wasn't.
No, I didn't. Where did the Tao come from?
Yeah.
Why spontaneously?
Yeah. Is it social constructs? Is it those are the questions that where people are playing with. But he would just say it corresponds to how the world, how humans interact with the world.
How about the fact that we're made in God's image?
Oh, again, now we're jumping into that's a different.
Right, we're jumping into something entirely.
As Christians, we have a very theological way of answering that question. So if that's what you're asking me, yeah, we could have a very clear anthropological discussion on who is man, who is God, why were we created. But again, he doesn't even want to start there with this crowd. But those of us raised in the church, raised in scripture, raised in catechesis, we have answers to these.
In the context of this lecture, does he answer that?
No. And that on purpose. He doesn't provide an answer. He's throwing out the question. We're so used to like, give me the answer. It's not that. He's provoking throughout the entire lecture. Good question. One more. Anybody else? Yes.
I got one. I hope this is not too big of a question, but
all right. Damned or condemned. Yeah. Yeah.
And then he talks about Paul later on, he knows the law so well, he knows how sufficient. That's out of context, too. He's talking about everything I gained, I count as Christ. So it's like he's cherry picking pieces of scripture to prove the universality of the Tao, but it doesn't seem to add up. I look at it.
The Paul one, I'll have to go back. I didn't read the John piece, the scripture. No, that's good. But the Paul one seems to make perfect sense because he understands. I mean, if you remember who Paul was, who he was a student of, steeped in the philosophical traditions, he could see the way, the chapter. And see this as he didn't abandon his philosophical thought. I mean, the way Romans is set up, the way his books are set up, is all because of his education and training. How he interacts, how he logically works through texts, and so Lewis, I think, is inferring that. Was that my 1 minute more? That was the lights flashing. God bless you. Let's come back next week and we'll hit it again.